The following episode of K-Voice was recorded at midnight, December 15th, 2017. Things may have changed by the time you listen to this show. Enjoy the show.
K-Voice of Resistance!
Hello, Resistance. This is K-Voice of Resistance. I'm Kelly, known by some as Kelly the Voice. There are many things these days that illustrate what very strange times we live in. Donald Trump is president. Bruce Jenner, now Caitlyn Jenner, is a woman. Powerful men are falling at a word from women. Russia is seen as an ally by the hawkish conservative wing of the government and country. A man who was rejected for a judgeship by the Reagan administration because he was too racist is now our attorney general. And now...
I gotta tell you, I think that I have been waiting all my life and now I just don't know what the hell to say.
Alabama, deep red, no, burgundy, Alabama, elected a pro-choice, pro-gun control Democrat to the Senate. The good guy won! Unbelievable! The election was so close. But still, it happened. I mean, Alabama came close to, way too close to electing an accused pedophile to the Senate, but they did not!
I'm loving it.
And you know what? It would not have been so very extremely close had the Supreme Court not gutted the Voting Rights Act. Stories had been pouring in from Alabama of voter suppression. Mother Jones reports, the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights under law received 235 calls to its voter hotline as of 3:24 p.m. The group aims to provide live assistance to voters, so it is unclear how many of those were reporting voting irregularities rather than simply asking for assistance. But the NAACP Defense Fund has been collecting reports of voting problems in Alabama, including multiple reports of people being put on inactive status and erroneously prevented from voting. According to NAACP, many voters were told that they couldn't vote, and others were given provisional ballots, when the correct procedure, I guess, is that voters who appear on the inactive list must be allowed the opportunity to re-identify and vote on a regular ballot. The group also collected reports of very long lines at precincts where poll workers say they were unprepared for high turnout. You see, Alabama's Secretary of State, Republican John Merrill, has repeatedly predicted low turnout in the special election. Election expert Michael McDonald of the University of Florida tweeted that this was, quote, bordering on malpractice to give this guidance to local election officials who should prepare for a higher turnout, unquote. And the group has also collected reports on people being prevented from voting by the state's photo ID laws because their IDs expired. Those terrible voter ID laws. On social media, reports poured in with claims that the precinct was denying inactive voters the right to cast a ballot if they did not remember the county they were born in. If true, this would violate federal law. The Alabama Secretary of State is none too talkative on the subject and did not respond to requests for comment about the incident. How disturbing is all this? Sure sounds a lot like Alabama of days past. You know, before the Voting Rights Act. Also, voters should not be put on inactive status unless they have not voted for 4 years, according to Alabama law, a stupid voter suppression law as it is. And there were people who reported that they were put on it even though they're regular voters. I think Progress reporter Kira Lerner received reports of voters on inactive status being turned away when they were legally allowed to cast a ballot. Ken Klipperstein, a contributor with the Daily Beast, saw cops arrive at a polling place where he was reporting in a majority black Montgomery. Quote, cop just arrived at the polling station. I'm here in Montgomery, Alabama. NAACP official told me that in previous Alabama elections, police have checked voters for outstanding warrants at polling stations, which can deter people from voting. Unquote. As MSNBC's best reporter and personal hero of mine, who I totally have a picture with, Joyanne Reed, said the night of the election, when the black turnout is high, we see more voter suppression.
The African-American community, thank you!
And it absolutely was black voters who won the election for Jones. According to exit polls, 29% of African-Americans in Alabama voted, slightly higher than the black turnout of 28% in the 2012 presidential election when Obama was on the ballot. The support for Jones among African-Americans was overwhelming. He received 96% of the overall black vote and 98% of the vote among black women. My hope is that this is all a wake-up call for Democrats. Democrats' most devoted and reliable voting bloc is the African-American vote, and at that, Black women specifically. And that has gotten lost in the past year with this knee-jerk obsession with the forgotten white American.
Forgotten? Since when were white Americans forgotten?
Democrats take the Black community for granted. They shouldn't, because they will not always be there. The Democratic Party has experienced an 11% drop in support from Black women, while the percentage of Black women who said neither party represents them jumped from 13% in 2016 to 21% in 2017. According to the Integrational Public Policy Network, in partnership with Essence Magazine, and conducted by the Black Women's Roundtable. These are numbers that should terrify Democrats.
That's right!
Now, should we take this as encouragement that Alabama is a state in play for House seats in 2018? Well, I mean, yes, we should fight for every seat in every state. And part of the reason that there's never any Democratic wins in Alabama is because Democrats don't even bother to put someone up or they can't find people willing to run. But there's more working against us. As Mother Jones explains, Alabama's 7th congressional district is the only one with a Democratic representative, and it contains nearly a third of all of the state's Black voters, ensuring that it is strongly Democratic, while the other two-thirds are scattered among the state's 6 other districts, making them a teeny tiny minority within the political voice. To achieve this clustering, the sprawling 7th District covers a large swath of central Alabama, where the state's Black Belt, originally named for the dark color of its soil, is home to many of its rural majority Black counties. But the district is not just rural. Instead, it sends tendrils into Birmingham into the north, Montgomery to the east, and towards Mobile to the south, scooping up Black areas from across the state into a single bizarrely shaped district. This is gerrymandering in action.
Gerrymandering.
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 We have seen Republicans rig the system with their gerrymandering, often illegal gerrymandering.
There is gerrymandering to a fare-thee-well in states controlled by the Republicans.
Some political gerrymandering is probably one of the greatest threats to our democracy right now.
So, our chances are slim for any other wins there. But for now, we have ourselves a shiny new Democratic senator named Doug Jones. Republicans currently hold a 2-vote margin over Democrats in the Senate. Losing the sitting senator from Alabama, Luther Strange, would shrink that teeny tiny margin to 1, which totally imperils the GOP tax scam. Remember in 2010, when then-President Barack Obama urged a delay on his health care overhaul bill until newly elected Massachusetts Republican Scott Brown could take the seat and vote on it? It guaranteed no vote, which nonetheless Obama pushed for. Why?
Why?
Why? Because Democrats have this obnoxious, if admirable, do-the-right-thing affliction. At the time, then-businessman Donald Lump told CNN in 2010 that Obama was very smart to seat Brown after the final votes on the health care bill.
Health care, he pulled back. He said now, you know, we have to give Massachusetts their vote, which was a very smart thing for him to say. But that may kill his health care plan. Boy, he has devoted an entire year and all of his capital to this one particular situation that a lot of people don't want. I really like him. We'll have to see how he does.
The Republicans, and specifically Mitch Turtle McConnell, are, of course, not going to allow Doug Jones into his duly elected spot in the Senate before their giant vote on their tax scam. A bill that is going to strip millions of Americans off healthcare and exponentially exacerbate the wealth gap. Most of the increase in wealth at the top has been due to fast rising incomes among the very richest Americans, while the annual income for the 1% at the top has shot up by 205% since 1980. And the top 0.001% of Americans,
that's only about 1,300 households,
has seen their earnings go up by 636%. All of that is according to the World Inequality Report, compiled by 5 economists, including Thomas Piketty and Emmanuel Saez, which found that the richest 1% of Americans held 39% of the nation's wealth in 2016, compared with just 22% in 1980. Meanwhile, the average annual income for the bottom 50% of Americans has stayed at $16,000 per adult over the last 4 decades, adjusting for inflation. In an editorial published in The Guardian alongside their new report, Piketty and his colleagues noted that the Republican tax plan that Congress is expected to vote on as early as next week will, quote, not only reinforce this trend, it will turbocharge the inequality in America, unquote. The report also finds that the tax bill would further leave out the bottom 50% of American earners, who have already been left out of the wealthy's income boom due to the collapse of the federal minimum wage laws, the weakened power of unions, and increasingly unequal access to higher education. Look, rising global inequality is not inevitable in the future. We can look to European nations who have enacted policies specifically designed to lessen the gap between rich and poor. In the report, they write, quote, if in the coming decades all countries follow the moderate inequality trajectory of Europe, over the past decades, global income inequality can be reduced. In which case, there can also be substantial progress in eradicating global poverty, unquote. So we can turn things around. But we most certainly will not be able to until 2020. And in 2020, you know what we do? We vote.
Vote.
We have to get out there, campaign, and vote.
Vote, vote, vote.
So if you have not heard, I will run down the victories this Alabama win has delivered. First, the media beloved and so-called strategic genius neo-Nazi Breitbart terrorist Stephen Sevenshirts Bannon has been revealed as the bumbling idiot that he has always been. And the claws are out for him on the right. Happy holidays. Donald looks like a big loser as he campaigned pretty hard for the pedophile Moore. Happy holidays. The Republican Party has witnessed twice now how ineffective the power of Donald is in elections that are not his own and are therefore less beholden to him. Happy holidays. With their newfound courage, Republicans have also discovered a modicum of integrity and have rejected a few of Donald's more outrageous, embarrassing nominations. Happy holidays! Yay! First, we have Michael Durson, who, our Republican president, decided over the summer should lead the EPA's Office of Chemical Safety. And, as is the norm with this administration, Durson has spent much of his career not only accepting money from the chemical industry, but also helping chemical companies fight against chemical safety regulations. Not only that, as MSNBC reports, emails recently came to public light showing Durson maintained correspondence with chemical industry officials, even after Trump nominated him for the EPA post, in which he would be overseeing toxic chemical regulation. The dude had an unusually close relationship with the American Chemistry Council and with individual companies whose products are scheduled for priority review by the EPA. Senators Richard Burr and Tom Tillis, both of North Carolina, had came out against this nomination in a strange show of integrity even before Alabama. But it wasn't till Alabama that Durson withdrew his name. And it didn't stop there. Also out are Brett Tully, who received a unanimous not qualified rating from the American Bar Association, who was up for a district court slot in Alabama, and Jeff Matier for a district court post in Texas. He was the one who called transgender children part of Satan's plan. The daffy-old curmudgeon Senator Chuck Grassley said this week that he'd urged the White House to drop Tully's bid and to reconsider Matier's nomination. Sadly, the Senate had already confirmed Stephen Graz to be U.S. Circuit Court judge for the Eighth Circuit on Tuesday. We talked about him on the Tuesday episode. He was another judge that the American Bar Association unanimously deemed unqualified and unable to serve without imposing his ideological extremist agenda. But reality still stands. As Huffington Post Jennifer Bendry wrote, Donald has already reshaped the courts by successfully confirming 12 circuit court nominees. The most any president has confirmed in the circuit courts were created in 1891. Along with those 12 judges, Trump's successful confirmation of Supreme Court Justice Neil Stolenseit Gorsuch and 6 district court judges could spell major trouble for abortion and LGBTQ rights.
Equal rights! Equal rights! Equal rights!
The confirmation on Halloween of the anti-choice Judge Amy Coney Barrett, who considers the Affordable Care Act's birth control mandate, quote, a grave infringement on religious liberty, unquote, and has publicly attacked the precedent set by Roe v. Wade. And another, John Bush, who was confirmed despite having compared abortion to slavery. There is Leonard Stephen Grass, who we've already talked about, who infamously sat on a nonprofit that promoted gay conversion therapy. Despite being quite openly opposed to abortion rights, Bendry noted that Grass was confirmed by pro-choice GOP senators Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins.
Cause they're cowards!
Sometimes.
Senator Whitehouse.
Thanks, Chairman. Let me join my colleagues in regretting the new precedent that this committee has set in packing two circuit court nominees into the same hearing without the permission or approval of both parties. That, I gather, is a novelty in the Judiciary Committee, and I believe it is a regrettable one.
Also confirmed this week is Don Willett to be U.S. Circuit Court Judge for the Fifth Circuit, confirmed with a vote 50-47. Willett has shown a willingness to shape his judicial decisions based on his personal policy views, often anti-LGBTQ and anti-worker. Yay! And James Ho was also confirmed to be U.S. Circuit Court Judge of the Fifth Circuit, and he was confirmed with a vote 53-43. James Ho has written that the U.S. should abolish all restrictions on campaign finance and help defend the use of torture while working on the Bush administration's Office of Legal Counsel. He is also often cited with extreme anti-LGBTQ stances. Yay!
I think the Judiciary Committee deserves better than this. I know you get your judges through when you do this, but I just think that from a point of view of the precedent of this committee, this is really getting embarrassing. I yield back my time.
Judgeships aren't the only place Republicans are wreaking havoc on minorities, women, and the poor. More than 10 million Americans lack broadband access. As The Hill notes, quote, "Good broadband is a small town's lifeline out of geographic isolation, its connection to business software and services, and its conduit for exploring homegrown ideas and products. Regulatory inducements are what gives corporate ISPs incentive to develop infrastructure in such areas." And on Thursday, it happened. On Thursday, the FCC ignored tens of millions of Americans' views, as well as comments from the world's leading internet scientists and inventors of the internet, and gave a huge regulatory gift to the telecom sector it is supposed to be regulating. Rolling back net neutrality and allowing those companies to extort blackmail money from the web publishers you try to access through their lines. The agency, which was supposed to protect us, has abandoned us.
Hi, I'm Ajit Pai. I'm the chairman of the FCC. Recently, there's been quite a bit of conversation about my plan to restore internet freedom. Here are just a few of the things you'll still be able to do on the internet after these Obama-era regulations are repealed.
The Federal Communications Commission, led by FCC Chairman Slumdog Shitheel Pai, voted to repeal its net neutrality rule.
You suck!
Oh, I have been harping on this for a while, to the point where you all might be a bit over the topic and of my bringing it up in my too short 30-minute shows, when there is so much stuff to talk about. I do it, and I have been, because it is so important. Here's why. In 2011, the Egyptian government heavily censored certain websites during its Arab Spring. And in Turkey, under the administration of President Erdogan, the country has become notorious for censoring websites and blocking hashtags, at one point banning Twitter altogether.
Can you imagine there are international conspiracies? Twitter, Mwitter, we have a court order now. We will wipe out all of these. The international community can say this, can say that. I don't care at all. Everyone will see how powerful the Republic of Turkey
is. Seems like something that could never happen in the United States, right? Like, something that extreme? But didn't it also seem a little crazy and extreme that Donald Trump could become president?
President. Hey, a president. Can you believe it, right?
As Vox explains, we have seen in the past that ISPs can and will censor access to controversial subjects. Without regulation, situations could arise in which underprivileged or disenfranchised individuals and groups have less access to speak up or contact others online. One worst-case scenario that we haven't seen in America but is absolutely possible given the current heated political climate and corrupt government we currently have, is that ISPs could potentially play a role in limiting or marginalizing certain communities during times of urgency. For instance, an ISP might choose to block a mobilizing hashtag like, say, hashtag Black Lives Matter.
Black Lives Matter! Black Lives Matter! Black Lives Matter!
Black Lives Matter at the start of an organic protest. A group that'll also be hit very hard by this is innovators and developers, people who create stuff for the internet. Tim Berners-Lee, creator of the internet as we know it, recently summed up the repeal's potential effect on these developers. Quote, "If the U.S. net neutrality rules are repealed, further innovators will have to first negotiate with each ISP to get their product onto that internet package. That means no more permissionless space for innovation. ISPs will have the power to decide which websites you can access and at what speed it will load. In other words, they'll be able to decide which companies succeed online, which voices are heard, and which are silenced." Unquote. Women, minorities, rural communities, and internet developers will be hit hardest and feel the fullest effects of this repeal. Without an open internet, members of a society who have historically been marginalized and silenced will be in danger of being further marginalized and silenced, or marginalized and silenced once more, particularly women and minorities. And finally, as Vox notes, the nature of the repeal is unprecedented, so we can't necessarily predict every group and every Democratic that could potentially feel its impact. But you can pretty much bet someone will be impacted and people will be hurt by this. But it's not the end, folks. We have lost the battle, but we have not lost the war.
It's a tired phrase, but you know, it works.
Wired pointed this out. They said that this action, quote, won't end the fight over rules that prohibit internet service providers from creating fast lanes for some content while blocking or throttling others, unquote. Here's how the fight can continue and how you can join the battle. First, the resistance unites to bring forth legal challenges. According to Boing Boing, first, public interest groups will sue over the lack of evidence in support of the FCC's order. Expert agencies are required to act on evidence. When the FCC brought down net neutrality rules in 2015, it did so on the basis of broad hearings and studies and a long-running comment period that established the need for the order. Donald's FCC proposes to roll back all net neutrality rules to pre-2005 levels, something it can only do by ignoring all the evidence, comments, and expert testimony, which will not sit well in the courts. In the right courts, that is. States are likely to enact their own net neutrality rules, which the FCC order forbids. These states will likely sue to prevent the FCC from telling them how to run their own network policy. This is a dangerous precedent, though, since a future FCC that restores net neutrality might find states using the same principle to opt themselves out of the rule.
Alabama!
Congress is already being lobbied heavily to intervene and force the FCC to enact net neutrality rules, and there's a strong likelihood that 2018 will see a swell of new Democratic lawmakers in the House who may be able to make this happen. They also warn that if we save net neutrality, we are still screwed so long as Ajit Pai is in charge of enforcing it. Already, 17 states so far have announced plans to sue the FCC over what New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman called the illegal rollback of net neutrality. Schneiderman is reportedly leading the multi-state legal action to reverse the FCC ruling. Attorneys generals have called previously for the FCC to delay the net neutrality vote so the investigators could look into more than 1 million fake comments reportedly sent to the FCC about net neutrality. Shapiro of Pennsylvania said this huge number includes tens of thousands of fake comments issued under names and addresses of real people. The theft of someone's voice in our democracy cannot stand, and we must first get to the bottom of this massive identity theft. Unquote. Go to badcommentsattorneysgeneral.gov. You can enter your name, and you can see if your comment was made under your identity. That is badcommentsattorneygeneral.gov. And besides legal action, there is also Congress and net neutrality legislation. According to Countable, there is the Save Net Neutrality Act. In December, Representative Sean Patrick Maloney, Democrat of New York, introduced the Save Net Neutrality Act. The bill went nowhere. But There have been renewed calls for Congress to get involved. And on Tuesday, over 35 Democrats and two independents sent a letter to Pai, urging him to abandon his proposal, which they called a stunning regulatory overreach. And Republicans have entered the debate. On Tuesday, Republican Senator John Thune of South Dakota asked for net neutrality supporters on both sides of the aisle to work with him on a legislative solution. Quote, "Congressional action is the only way to solve the endless back and forth on the net neutrality rules that we've seen over the past several years," unquote. Thune did not say he supported Pai's proposal, but the South Dakota senator said that he's open to compromise. Quote, "If my colleagues on the other side of the aisle and those who claim to support net neutrality rules want to enshrine protections for consumers with the backing of the law, I call on you today to join me in discussing legislation that would do just that," unquote. And hours before Thursday's vote, Maine Senators Susan Collins, a Republican, and Angus King, an independent, asked the FCC to cancel their vote and give Congress time to hold public hearings. In a letter to Pai, Maine senators wrote, quote, "This is a matter of enormous importance with significant implications for our entire economy and therefore merits the most thorough, deliberate, and thoughtful process that can be provided. The process thus far in this important matter has not met that standard," unquote. Now, if all that fails, there's always the 2020 election. Pai and the FCC's two other GOP members voted to enact the Restoring Internet Freedom Act. The two Democrat commissioners both dissented. Pai was appointed by Donald, but a left-leaning president could appoint a Democratic chairman to put net neutrality protections back in place. So, yay, 2020! Don't forget to vote!
Vote!
Finally, before I go, I have some good news. The World Bank will end its financial support for oil and gas extraction within the next 2 years in response to the growing threat posed by climate change. In a statement that delighted campaigners opposed to fossil fuels, the bank used a conference in Paris to announce, quote, "it will no longer finance upstream oil and gas after 2019. The bank ceased lending for coal-fired power plants in 2010, but has been under pressure from lobby groups also to halt the $1 billion a year it's been lending for oil and gas in developing countries. The bank said that it saw the need to change the way it was operating in a rapidly changing world, adding that it was on course to have 28% of its lending going to climate action by 2020. At present, 1-2% of the bank's $280 billion portfolio is accounted for by oil and gas projects. It does say that in exceptional circumstances, the bank would consider lending for oil and gas projects in the very poorest countries, but only where it helped the poor to get access to energy and the project didn't conflict with commitments to reduce greenhouse gases made in the 2015 Climate Change Accord. Progress is being made. In some ways small, but in others, very big. Thank you for sticking with me and this episode of K, Voice of Resistance. You can stream or download this show at crabdiving.com under the Crab Diving tab or on your favorite podcasting app. I'm also at citizentruth.org. Follow me on Twitter at Kelly the Voice and on Facebook, where you will find the stories I have discussed in the show and more at K, Voice of Resistance. If you want to laugh and rage at your liberal progressive news, I suggest checking out the Crab Diving Podcast with host Patrick Vile and comedian Ryan Pfeiffer, 2 hours a day, Monday through Friday. All right, take care of yourselves out there. And as always, resist.
Resist!
At times, history and fate meet at a single time, in a single place, to shape a turning point in man's unending search for freedom. So it was at Lexington and Concord. So it was a century ago at Appomattox. So it was last week in Selma, Alabama.